You're listening to KRCB-FM 104.9, Sonoma County's NPR station, and this is our winter fundraiser. If you like what you hear, pledge and support at krcb.org/join. Hi there, I'm Greg Moralia, host of Outbeat News in Depth and the weekly Outbeat News segment here on KRCB. Each week I share stories from the LGBTQ community from around the world and here locally on the Outbeat News segment, which airs at the beginning of every Outbeat radio show on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. And then, on the fourth Sunday of each month, we take an in-depth look at some of the stories making news on Outbeat News in Depth. Thanks for listening to KRCB-FM 104.9, and remember, your support makes our programs possible. Pledge your support now by going to krcb.org/join. Outbeat Radio.
Welcome to Outbeat Radio, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight we have Greg Moralia, our friend and engineer.
This is things that people don't really know about Greg, okay? Greg started his career in law enforcement early as a cadet at the age of 15, that's 1-5 people, in 1978. And that was the same year Harvey Milk took office and the rainbow flag was created. He started teaching part-time at the police academy in Napa in 1986.
Since that time, he worked for three law enforcement agencies before moving into education full-time. In 2016, he left his position as dean and returned to the classroom full-time, where he is now professor of criminal justice and the LGBT studies.
And most recently, Greg just gave a training at Quantico to the FBI, and you will want to listen in about his experience and all of its future implications.
Welcome, Greg.
Hey, it's good to be here. It's always fun to hang out.
Yeah, it's quite different, you being our guest versus being our news giver.
Yeah, and it's fun because we haven't been together in the studio now since before COVID.
Right, right. So it is nice seeing you kind of in person, sort of, kind of.
So stay tuned to learn more about that and everything else about Greg. But first, here's news and events from Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralia.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of December 5th, 2021. Out songwriter and composer Stephen Sondheim died a week ago Friday at the age of 91. Sondheim's work reshaped American musical theater and has influenced generations of songwriters. His success stretched from the 1950s, writing lyrics for West Side Story, to the 1990s, writing for such musicals as Assassins and Passion. The first Broadway show he wrote the music and lyrics for was the 1962 comedy A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. It won a Tony Award for Best Musical. The New York Times noted that the 1970s and 1980s were his most productive years. His works in those decades included Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Pacific Overtures, Sweeney Todd, Merrily We Roll Along, Into the Woods, and Sunday in the Park with George. According to the 2013 HBO documentary, Six by Sondheim, he liked to write his music lying down and would occasionally have a cocktail to help him write. He also revealed in the documentary, directed by frequent collaborator James Lapine, that he only fell in love after he turned 60. Most recently, he had been in a relationship for several years with Jeff Romley. And in Tennessee, advocates have confirmed that a victim in an apparent carjacking and murder weeks ago was a 35-year-old transgender woman. She was misgendered in reports of her death by local media and the police. Police are searching for a man seen on camera as he jumped into the victim's vehicle after shooting her in cold blood. many reports of conflicting information. Danny Yale, with a last name Johnson, according to some, was shot to death in Memphis early on November 7, 2021. This was based on local reports and police statements. But the Human Rights Campaign reports her last name is Thompson, said she died on November 13th. The shooting took place outside the Bellevue Inn, a motel right next to Jesse Turner Park in the city's Roselle area. This is located close to downtown. Danielle's body was discovered and taken to a hospital where she was declared dead. Police believe her shooter drove off in a 2010 black Nissan Altima right after. Little other information has been offered about Danielle's death, and a few reports of the shooting refer to her as a man. The Memphis Police Department tweeted that she was, quote, a male shooting victim, end quote. According to the Human Rights Campaign, she is at least the 48th victim of fatal violence against trans and gender nonconforming people so far in 2021. And according to the Bay Area Reporter, here in California, four women who are incarcerated in the state prison system filed a lawsuit in federal court against the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, seeking the court to declare gay Senator Scott Wiener's Senate Bill 132 unconstitutional under both the state and federal constitutions. SB 132 was signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom last year and went into effect this last January. The law allows incarcerated transgender people to ask for a transfer to a state prison or detention center that matches their gender identity. The law requires that the Department of Corrections record each individual's self-reported gender identity, gender pronouns, and honorifics. It also requires the Department of Corrections to house transgender people at a correctional facility based on their preference, whether that be their gender identity or sex assigned at birth. All Department of Corrections staff, contractors, and volunteers must consistently use the appropriate gender pronouns and honorifics that the individual has requested in all communications with or regarding them. The suit was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of California in Fresno. The complaint alleges that Senate Bill 132 violates parts of the federal Constitution, including the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, the First Amendment's protections of freedom of speech and religion because of the pronoun and honorifics requirement, and the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause because the law allegedly imposes on female offenders increased risks of physical assault. And finally, don't forget the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus returns here to the North Bay with their annual holiday concert supporting Face-to-Face of Sonoma County. This year's concert will be director Tim Seelig's last before he retires in 2022. This year's special concert will feature the very best of the last 10 years along with some brand new pieces. The concert happens at the beautiful Green Center on the Sonoma State University campus at 5 p.m. on Saturday, December 18th. Tickets are available at f2f.org. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglia.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan. And as our guest tonight, we have Greg Moraglia, who is going to share his experiences with education and law enforcement. And Greg, thanks again for taking time out of your busy schedule for joining us tonight.
Of course, anytime. It's great to be here.
So good to have you. It's nice to have you as our guest and not just hear your voice on the news, giving the news. So really, it's wonderful. Thank you.
If people could see us now, we'd be like full of smiles. It's so nice, you know?
Well, it's crazy because we've all felt like we've just been so disconnected since the COVID thing happened. We haven't done anything in the studio together. So yeah, it's fun to reconnect.
Yes. And I was so excited when I found out about the Quantico thing and what you were doing with the FBI. But before we get there,
okay,
let's start at the beginning, because I was shocked when you told me that you started your career when you were 15. Can you start there and let us know what attracted you to what you were doing at a young age of 15 at Y Cadet, and tell us more about your travels?
Yep. So I had always wanted to be a teacher my entire life, you know, from as far back as I can remember. And law enforcement was never on my radar. It wasn't anything that I ever even considered doing. My dad was a firefighter. He's a 30-year career firefighter. And he asked me one day if I wanted to go on a ride-along with a friend of his who was a deputy sheriff in a small town in the Bay Area called Lafayette. I said, sure, yeah, that's all right. And so this deputy pulls up and he gets out of his 1978 Dodge Monaco, which is this gigantic, you know, behemoth of a car. And he, I'll never forget, he walks up to the door to pick me up, and he's got his mirrored sunglasses on and his cowboy boots on. And then we went out, and I can remember everything we did that day. I was completely enamored with it, and I was hooked. And so that led to my dad introducing me to a dispatcher friend of his at Walnut Creek Police Department, and they had a cadet program. And so she told me about that, and I sat in and watched the dispatch center, and I was completely taken with that. And I said, I got to do this. I'm in. Sign me up. So I joined the cadets early on, and that's where I spent my, that's how I survived high school, frankly.
Huh. So you were 15, I was in 10th grade. Were you about a 10th grader?
Yeah, that was my freshman year of high school.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yep.
So I want to know a little, just a little bit more about you driving around with the, watching the guy with the dark glasses on. I mean, you didn't have to, you know, he didn't arrest anybody or anything like that. You just.
We went to some alarm calls, some burglar alarm calls. He made a few traffic stops. You know, we got something to eat and, you know, drove around the neighborhood, and it was cool. It was cool.
Okay. You know, Greg, you're giving me a flashback of a memory that I had when I was in high school. They had a ride-along program with police officers, mm-hmm. and I did that. And I haven't thought about that. I was probably 15, too. And I remember just riding around. We were talking. All of a sudden, I didn't hear what was going on in the radio. And all of a sudden, he went from maybe 40 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour because he got a call. And I was scared to my bones. And then I have no recollection what happened after that. But it was very, very exciting, I remember. So I could really understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. I was totally hooked on the job with all aspects of it. You know, I loved the dispatching end of it. There was no 911 then, but the dispatching end of it was fantastic. And then, you know, being out on the street was super exciting.
We didn't have anything like that in my neighborhood in Louisiana, in my school. We didn't ride along with the police department.
Yeah.
But thanks for sharing that, Cher. Yeah.
That's good.
So you said it got you through high school. So tell us a little bit about why that is so.
It was my interest. So I think an important part of this is that I knew I was gay since seventh grade. You know, it was very, very clear to me, though I didn't accept that word, and I certainly didn't come out. But I knew I had an attraction to other boys at that time in seventh grade. And I knew at that time it was also very clear that that was just not something you could be. I grew up in a Catholic household. It wasn't that there was any outwardly negative, oppressive kinds of words from the pulpit or from my parents, but there was enough going on around me, certainly, that I knew that that wasn't something I could be. As much as I love my first police department, I remember the first hour, the first day that I walked in there, and all of the anti-gay, don't be a queer, don't be gay, and worse, that I heard. And so the messaging was very clear, right, that you couldn't be out. So you couldn't be out at high school, certainly couldn't be out there, but the police department also gave me a place to hide because I never had to worry about explaining why I wasn't going to any of the dances, why I didn't want to go to prom, why I didn't want to be involved in any of the, you know, normal high school stuff. And, you know, what parent could complain that their kid was spending their weekends at a police station? They didn't have to worry about me going out and drinking, right? So for me, I had a friend set there that was safe. I had a purpose that was there, and it really took a lot of questions away from me. It ended up being a really good place.
Wow, that is certainly a beautiful thing that you found, that you discovered.
Yeah.
I never thought about it was a good place for you to hide, and it makes so much sense. Yeah. You were always busy. You didn't have to worry about anything. Wow.
Yep. Yep. So it gave me a purpose. It gave me something to do. I was getting good experience. The only other thing I did in high school was play in our marching band. And
what did you play, Greg?
I played clarinet, which I absolutely disliked every aspect of it. And in my later years, I took over. I was the band manager. So I, you know, did all of the logistics stuff, which was fun because I could go on all the trips and deal with all of that. And that was fun. But that was really the only thing about high school that I at all enjoyed.
Did you have any other friends like you that you knew that were gay?
Oh, no. But
no club? No, nothing?
No, there was nothing at the time. I mean, there were people in my high school class that were thought to be gay and ended up being gay. They came out later, and they were horribly abused, you know, bullied. It was not a good scene if you were even thought to be gay. And there were enough other people that were thought to be gay where the spotlight was clearly off of me. I didn't have anything to worry about.
Were you one of those kids that would wear your uniform to school on days that you were going to be participating in some activity? I mean, like the Boy Scouts would always wear their uniforms on meeting days, or Girl Scouts too.
Well, being in police work back then was not super popular. So, you know, you could easily be called a narc and all of that kind of stuff. And so I didn't, you know, people knew I was involved, but just sort of on the periphery. I didn't do that. Wasn't smart.
Hey, just before we leave your high school experience, just curious, did you have an adult that you could feel comfortable around, a teacher or principal or somebody?
Oh, no way. No way. I found out later on that two of my junior high teachers were gay and that they were a couple, and they'd actually been together for 40 years. So it was actually the first day of my seventh grade year. My first teacher was a social science teacher, Ray Lippincott. Never forget him. Great storyteller. You know, perfect social science teacher. And then my last teacher of the day was Walter Mast. If he was a stereotypical gay art teacher, if there was one, it was him. You know, he had all the mannerisms, he had the look, he had everything. And the kids, I remember, were horrible to him. Horrible to him. What I didn't know is that Ray and Walt were partners, and they had been together for 40 years. And of course, this is right at the time when Prop 6 was going on. If you remember the Briggs Initiative, where the voters would have, and potentially, if that had passed, both of them would have been fired.
But were they out, though? I mean,
No, not to the students.
Yeah.
There were teachers at the school who knew, but not to the students. They could never talk about that. Moving fast forward to, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, I actually reconnected with Ray before he died. And I wrote him a letter and said, you know, this is who I am. And he remembered me. And I said, how interesting, how much better it would have been if we could have all been out.
And Ray was your social science teacher, correct?
Yeah, social studies. His partner, Walt, the art teacher, passed away in 2002. So I never got a chance to reconnect with him, but I got a chance to talk to Ray.
Thank you for those memories, Greg. Yeah. It's always nice to learn a little bit more about you.
Yeah, it's fun to share.
And so when exactly did you get into the police academy? I mean, exactly, because you didn't go to college in between high school.
Yeah, so when I graduated high school, I got hired as a 911 dispatcher full-time, and then I was going to college at the same time. So I'd work graveyard shift, get off at 8 in the morning, and go to school, which may explain why I got a D in astronomy, right? I could barely keep my eyes open, but yeah, I did that, and then did my academy training about the same time, because I started working as a sworn officer when I was 21.
That's so young.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
That's the age.
Is it?
California just upped the minimum age from 18 to 21 this year.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yep. Babies being police officers.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, and age is kind of an arbitrary thing, right? I mean, there's some people who are very mature at 21 and others who aren't mature ever.
So you said you never got from the pulpit or from your family outwardly negative comments, but how was it with your family and you being gay and knowing you were gay? And when did you come out to them, or did you come out to them?
It was never even an option that I considered, because I didn't think that they would understand it. I didn't even try to think about the possibilities of them trying to have them understand it. It just wasn't even anything that I desired to do. Mm-hmm. So I just kept it entirely separate. I didn't come out to them until I was 41.
Oh my goodness.
Now, you know, I think my mom started to wonder when I was 30 and really hadn't brought any girls home and hadn't talked about dating and hadn't talked about marriage, but I was very career driven at the time. And so they never really pushed, never really asked. She asked me on my 30th birthday when I was going to bring a young woman home. And, you know, I just sort of sidestepped that whole conversation. But it was never even something I considered doing.
So why when you were 41?
Well, that, yeah. So in 2000, the short story is that I met Judy Shepard, Matthew Shepard's mom. Mm-hmm. So I'd watched a documentary about his murder, and I didn't really know much about it. But I was moved to write her and say, hey, you know, I'm working in law enforcement here in California. We're doing a lot of hate crimes prevention work. And that led to meeting her. She had just been involved in a documentary called The Journey to a Hate-Free Millennium. And she was touring around with the documentarian and a couple of other speakers. And so the short story is I got a chance to bring her to Napa Valley College, where I was working, and had her do a community presentation back then. And I was taken by her, taken by the story. And she, like Harvey Milk, talked about the way that we're going to change hearts and minds is by people coming out and sharing their stories. And I heard her say that over and over and over again. And I started doing some work with the Matthew Shepard Foundation then, and finally decided at age 41, it was time. You know, it was time. Now, we were in a totally different place in society. I was in a totally different place career-wise. I was at the police academy full-time in a college environment that's pretty liberal, and I felt pretty confident that I would be okay career-wise. I was working for another small police department, but I was pretty convinced that it would be okay. And so I did it.
How did you do it? What did you say? And who was your audience?
So I'm a believer that people come into your life for a reason. I really think that's true. Because the first person I told, I think by all counts, would have been a foolish choice. You know, if you just said, hey, would you consider doing it this way? I would have said, that's crazy. So I had a student in one of my classes who I was pretty sure was gay. I wasn't sure, but I was pretty sure. And there was just something I felt. He was interested in learning more about Matthew Shepard Foundation, and I was pretty sure he was the person I was supposed to tell. And so I did something again that you should never do, which is asked him to meet outside of class if we want to talk more about Matthew Shepard Foundation and maybe common life experiences. And so we got together after class, and I came out to him, and he was the first person I told. And he was gay. In fact, he had had a bet with his roommates that was why I was getting together with him, was to come out. So he had kind of figured me out as well. So that was it.
Wow. Sounds like you're a blessing for both of you, maybe.
Yeah.
Was he, because you weren't sure that he was out already. I mean.
And he was. He had been out for a long time. I don't know that it was as much a help to him as it was to me, but that started me on a journey to be who I am.
Oh, how was it with your parents?
I waited a few months after I told him. The night that I told him, I was definitely afraid that I'd made a huge mistake. I was worried about all the ethical issues there. I was worried about just reaction, word getting out. It was like for most people or many people, it was a significant emotional event for sure. I started out by talking to my sister. I told her first. I knew that she couldn't keep her mouth shut and would probably tell my mom. And I was okay with that. And so my mom was totally fine. She had had some wonder already about it. My dad, who, you know, conservative, sort of, Italian, firefighter, Catholic, that whole stereotype, I didn't know how he was going to react. And so I ended up writing him a letter, and I overnighted it to him. So took it down to the post office, overnight mail, and then I sat by the phone and waited. And he called, and, you know, he was great. I sent the letter to him because I wanted him to process all of the things one line at a time so that he wouldn't take on the, it was my fault, I wasn't around enough, all of that stuff. And so I took each of those things on, and I just said, this has nothing to do with you being a firefighter. It has nothing to do with, you know, perhaps not being around as much, nothing. This is just who I am. So he was great. He said, you know, I got your letter. Thank you so much. I love you. I just wish you were here so I could give you a hug.
Oh, my God.
Right? So I go, okay, well, I'm on my way. I drove down that night, and we had just this great talk. And he's been super, just super. I feel very, very fortunate to have a very supportive family.
Looking back, I'm just curious at this moment of coming out to your family and the way they welcomed you and took that information. I'm just curious, do you have any regrets that maybe you could have done it sooner? I'm just curious what your thought pattern was.
Sure. I've thought about shoulda, coulda, woulda. I don't know. I think it was the right time in the right place. It would have been great if I would have had the courage to come out. I think I underestimated my family for sure. I didn't give them near the credit. I didn't give my friends the credit that they deserved at all. But it is what it is. And I made very deliberate decisions about what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. And so that's what I have to live with. But it was the right time and the right place and the right set of circumstances. So I just have to go with that.
Yeah, you certainly are pointing to the fact that in order for a person to come out, they really have to feel safe.
Yep. It's really important.
They can't do it on anyone else's timeline. And you're really, by listening to you, kind of reiterating that whole concept.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really believe that. And it's the individual story to tell. I mean, we all know people who have been outed by, you know, evil people in their lives. And that takes something away from that person. So, yeah, I agree.
And so this is something probably you talk about a lot in your classes. And I would like to get into the educational part of what you do. I know you meet a lot of different students in your LGBTQ plus classroom. So,
you know, it's interesting. I think people from in the outside of our community who haven't had the experience think that, oh, well, coming out isn't a big deal anymore. You know, what's the big deal? And it is still a significant emotional event for folks. I meet law enforcement people fairly regularly who are still struggling with whether or not they can come out or not. And it's a very personal decision, and it's a tormenting one for them. So, you know, it's not helpful at all if I go, oh, well, it's a piece of cake. It was easy for me. Well, in my circumstances at that particular time, it ended up being easy. But actually doing it certainly wasn't.
Yeah, I agree. So, I have the same experience. A lot of people have this belief that everything's okay because we're in 2021. Yeah. But there are still a lot of people in the closet, afraid for whatever reason, not trusting to come out. So, yeah.
Yep, it's true.
So Diana brought up the LGBT studies program at your college. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because you designed it. You brought it forward. It was your baby, or it is your baby. Can you tell us the evolution of that?
One of the questions that sometimes comes up is, well, what happened to your career, you know, after you came out? And I would have to say that my career exploded and got 1,000 times better. I've had so much opportunity that I'm grateful for there. And I would have never in my wildest of dreams thought that I would be teaching an LGBT studies program at any college anywhere. It just wasn't even on the radar. But I came out in 2004. In 2009, if you remember, there was a lot of media coverage around the LGBT youth suicide rate, right? There was this belief that we've got this epidemic in our nation. And really, it was the media covering what has always been a problem and what continues to be a problem. But that started a conversation at Napa Valley College in the faculty ranks about, hey, what are we doing to support our LGBT students? There was no club. There was nothing in place, as there wasn't in most colleges. And so I knew of some LGBT studies programs that were out there. And I said, well, why don't we develop one? I tried to work with one faculty member who said, yeah, well, I'm kind of busy. And so I said, well, can I do it? Can I build the program? And so I was allowed to do that. And it started out as a small certificate program, and now we have a whole 2-year degree with 5 different classes, and it's one of only 3 degrees in California.
That is fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. You know, both of you I've had as guest speakers in the class, which I'm totally grateful for, because, you know, students need to see, they still don't have enough role models, right? They don't have enough people that are close to them to be able to see what the possibilities are for them. You've had the experience. It's fun, right? I mean, they're really great students.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we've been to your class to talk to your kids maybe, I don't know, 6 or 8 times every semester.
Almost every time I've done that class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I find the students so attentive and very curious and even approach us after and want to talk more or get in touch with Diana since she's a therapist. I mean, the implications of us coming and for the future and for you giving this information and for them doing the exploration is just immense. I mean, we really won't know the repercussions of their education with you.
Yep. We awarded our first 2 associate degrees last spring for LGBT studies because the degree program was just finalized last fall. So we gave the first two degrees in the spring. One of the students has already gone out and gotten a job working with schools and is going to be supporting LGBT students. So that's fantastic. I had another student who got the certificate and got a job as a social worker in a county in California. And the reason that she was selected for the job was because she had that certificate. That was an area of expertise that their office did not have. So I hear, you know, stories like that are the first signs to me that it's going to make a difference. So it's cool.
You reminded me of a quote my mom always told us when growing up, he who rocks the cradle rocks the world. And if you see your program as you got these little babies and you're educating them and now they're going out and you don't know who they're going to touch and who they're going to affect and what kids they're going to save from self-harm. I mean, congratulations to you, Greg. Mm-hmm. So exciting.
Yeah, thanks. It's very fulfilling. I get as much out of it as I hope the students do. So.
Well, it is time for our music break. You did bring a song, and I do want to remind the listeners that when we come back from our music break, we're going to talk a little bit more about how you have undergone some changes in the FBI. I'm so excited to hear about that. So anyway, why don't you tell us about the song you brought? We'll play it, and then we'll get right back to everyone.
You know, there's so many songs I love. I mean, I really like music in general, but I think for this conversation, I've got to go with Heather Small's Proud. I first heard it while watching Queer as Folk shortly after I came out, and I don't know, the words just really spoke to my experience.
I look into the window of my mind. Reflections of the fears I know I've left behind. I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascend.
just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diane and Sheridan, and we are talking with Greg Moralia. And Greg is talking to us about his life as a LGBT instructor and designer of the program over at Napa College. And Greg, I'd like to ask you about the law enforcement LGBT awareness training that you designed, if you can talk to us about that.
Yep. So believe it or not, there was no requirement for law enforcement officers to have any instruction, training, exposure to the LGBT community. I mean, cultural diversity training as sort of a general topic is relatively new. When I did my academy training, there was nothing, no discussion about any of that. And so we've, you know, it's come a ways, but there was still nothing around LGBT issues. So again, by happenstance, got a chance to work with Assemblymember Evan Lowe from the South Bay. Equality California had had an interest in seeing a training mandate required of law enforcement. And so I was invited to a meeting to talk with the Assemblymember and Equality California and got a chance to draft the bill that became law in January of 2019. So the bill requires that all law enforcement officers and 911 dispatchers get LGBT awareness training. All existing personnel and then all new people coming into the profession moving forward, you know, have to have this training. And it talks about really five areas. What's sexual orientation? What's gender identity? How does that intersect with race, religion, nationality, terminology, a little bit of history? How can we make an inclusive workplace for LGBT employees? And then how can we better respond to things like domestic violence and hate crimes? So that's the content. And my commitment in terms of writing the bill and helping it through is that we would develop a model course that people could take in California. So we did that at the Academy in Napa, launched it, created an online course for departments to use, an in-person course, all the content, everything is there, and it's all essentially free for them to use. So that's going on around the state.
So you worked with the people, you helped get the bill passed, and then you created your own curriculum for your academy at Napa College, and that was an in-person serving them. And then you also made it online for departments all over the state to access if they so wished.
Right. The online course that we developed, we actually developed back in 2016 and started offering it nationally. So it's available, it's been available nationally since 2016. And then, you know, we updated it, of course, to meet the requirements of the new California law.
You know that people are using it nationally, your program in particular?
Oh, yeah. 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 We've had departments put their entire rank and file through it. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania was one of those departments. Breckenridge, Colorado is one of the regular users of it. We've trained, I want to say, close to 2,000 people so far in that program.
If there's anyone listening out there, could you give the address for where they could access this curriculum?
Yep. If you go to Out to Protect, all one word, outtoprotect.org, that is a nonprofit organization that I created back in 2009 that now hosts all of the training, and the content there is available for law enforcement nationally. So there's a hate crimes class, there's a LGBT awareness class, and then a train the trainer that's available.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
It's really clear your passion, Greg. I mean, you said earlier about wanting to educate.
Yep.
And you get the opportunity. You've had these opportunities to do exactly what you wanted to do, and I feel your passion. So congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, it goes back to what Judy Shepard said, I think, that the way we change hearts and minds is by sharing our stories. And, of course, you both are educators. You know that in the classroom, that's how we get students to learn, and that's how we move people. So it's the best way, I think. You can put whatever you want in a law, but laws don't make people change their minds.
Right. They encourage it, but they don't make it. You got to have that relationship building part of it.
Yep. Yep. That's right.
So tell us the evolution of this course and how you proceeded in your life.
So once the law was implemented, And I'll just say, I'll give credit to California's legislature. The bill passed with unanimous bipartisan support, and Jerry Brown signed it into law. Albeit he waited until the last hour of September 30th, which was the very last day that he could have signed the bill. We were kind of waiting on pins and needles. He did it. So it went into effect. And the state's been pretty responsive about getting it up and running into basic training programs, basic academy programs throughout the state. More agencies now are realizing they need to provide the training. I think there's some frustration because there's so much pressure on law enforcement to provide training to people on implicit bias and cultural diversity and community policing. Meanwhile, there's a staffing shortage, and so it's been a struggle for people to comply with the law and get it done in a timely manner. But, you know, departments are doing it slowly but surely. I just got done training all of Berkeley PD, so they put 265 people through. St. Helena PD, Gilroy, Mountain View, Morgan Hill, you know, to name a few.
So who are the trainers?
Those departments I just mentioned, they sent all their people through our online course. So I designed the training on there, but they can go through and complete it all on their own. And then, you know, I teach a train the trainer course. So for departments that want to put on training like on their own, then people can come and get trained on how to do it and how to design it on their own.
That's so exciting. Mm-hmm. So tell us how you went from there to the FBI, and tell us about your FBI experience. I'm just so excited to hear about it.
I guess for me personally, it was sort of a pinnacle moment of a career. I mean, the FBI is sort of a revered law enforcement agency, at least for me it was. Quantico is sort of a mysterious place. The FBI Academy has a really great reputation for really doing some innovative things. And so even the opportunity to go back there and visit it for me personally was important. It was big. For me, it started with an FBI agent who reached out from the FBI's partner Office of Partner Engagement, and he was looking for that group forms relationships between the FBI and different identity groups. So the Black Peace Officers Association, Women's Peace Officers Association, Asian Peace Officers Association, they didn't have anything for LGBT. So he approached me and said, would Out to Protect like to be that organization? And I said, well, of course, yes, absolutely. On board. From there, he said, would you be interested in coming out to the FBI Academy and doing a presentation there? We've never done any kind of LGBT awareness training ever in the Academy's history. I said, well, absolutely. Whatever it is we need to do, I definitely would love to have that audience. So there's two programs there. One is their New Agent Academy. That's for all the new FBI agents. And then they have what's called the National Academy program. That's been running since, I think, 1935, if I remember the history right. They bring in law enforcement executives from law enforcement agencies across the country and many other foreign countries. And they're there for 11 weeks, and they're supposed to learn the latest and greatest innovations in law enforcement. And so that was the audience we were invited to talk to. So my thinking was, okay, well, this is a chance to share the course with people from across the U.S. and show them what is possible, and then also do some education with them. So when we worked on developing this training, they scheduled it over 3 days. So it was going to be three different sessions. And one of the things we wanted to do was have a panel of LGBT law enforcement folks, and specifically National Academy graduates to come. So that we found a couple of people to participate in that. Well, it was scheduled, then COVID happened, and they canceled all their training, and we were delayed for almost a year. And I wasn't sure it was ever going to happen. When we first started this, it was during the Trump administration, and the Trump administration had given an executive order to discontinue any cultural diversity training at all in all federal entities. So there were people on the FBI staff who would not even meet with us because of that executive order. Fast forward, Trump's gone, Biden's in, and they're on board. And so we finally got it scheduled, and they said, okay, we're going to schedule it and, you know, fly out here and let's do it.
So were you the sole giver of the knowledge, or did you have a team?
No, I brought a team in. So it was myself and my colleague at the Police Academy in Napa, Damian Sandoval, who is our academy director. He's a straight ally. But he and I have been teaching cultural diversity for 21 years together. So he came out to be a facilitator, and then we brought in two National Academy graduates, a captain from Chula Vista PD in Southern California, a gay man, and a captain from Westminster PD in Maryland, a lesbian. Both of them had graduated from the National Academy. And then we brought in our FBI agent who facilitated all of this. So that made up our panel, because the panel discussion we thought was going to be important. So we did a first session where we did sort of the basic LGBT awareness training. And then the second session was that we ended up combining with the planned third one. But we did a panel on their experiences and LGBT liaison programs, and it was storytelling.
How many people were in your audience?
So there was 108 National Academy students, which is about half of what they usually have. They usually have a class with over 200, but because of COVID, they were down to 108. There was one assistant director of the FBI there to watch it, and then several other high-ranking folks to watch it to see if they wanted to continue it. It was something. I mean, even just getting there, Quantico's about an hour out of Washington, D.C., and did you all watch Silence of the Lambs?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Remember that? Remember with Clarice?
Yes.
Right? So it looks, I mean, they filmed the Academy portions of it there. So you would never know any of that exists. I mean, it's in a town called Stafford, Virginia. It's very, very rural. Very rural. You access the base, and it's on a Marine Corps base right off the highway, but there's just a small sign that says Quantico Marine Corps Base, and there's several entrances to it. It's huge. It is just huge, but it's all hidden in this forest. So you make the right-hand turn, and you drive down this long road where there's nothing. It's just all forest, and then you come to a Marine Corps military base entrance, and the security to get in is absolutely phenomenal. We had to go through a background check before we got there, and then we had to get there, and we had to do a fingerprint and a picture and get this pass to get in. And there's Marines with, you know, rifles all over the place. And then you drive in there, drive down the road, and then there's all these different training facilities that the military uses. So there's a compound just for where they train security for the embassies all over the world. That's their training center. And they've got a embassy set up there. It's really interesting. The FBI has a compound that's within this base with their own complete set of security that you have to go through to get on. They have their own police, their own thing. Another layer. So we get in there, and then there's this gigantic facility where they have the academy training. The FBI, National FBI Crime Lab is there, big multi-story complex. Their center where they coordinate all of the hostage negotiations and special operations that the FBI does around the world. Their whole command center there is there, their training center's there. They have a whole little city set up that they call Hogan's Alley that's there, that's fascinating. And then the actual training academy itself is there.
Well, when you say a whole city set up, I'm thinking probably restaurants and things for people to eat and...
Oh yeah, but it's all for their simulation. So they have, you know, banks and hotels that are set up for SWAT teams and for, you know, scenario work to be done. One of the restaurants, though, in the Hogan's Alley is a Subway, and it actually operates. You can go in there and buy a sandwich.
Okay. Diana's a little more worldly than I am, I think.
No. But so you were like, your eyes were wide open, huh?
I was fascinated by the whole thing. And they were great. They showed us all around. You know, we got the whole tour of a place. It's very, very, very impressive.
This is a big deal. This is a big deal for you to be there to do this work with them.
Yeah. Personally, yeah, it was very, very, I was honored to be able to do it. So
what do you think going to come out of it? I mean, as far as you moving forward and them wanting more work from you, yeah, or what?
So we got some interesting reactions. As you might imagine, there were people that didn't like the fact we were there and wanted nothing to do with it. They weren't having it.
Were they there present with that attitude?
They didn't have any choice. They were ordered to be there. So there were people with their arms folded. There were people that were rolling their eyes. There was that group. No one was rude, but you could tell. We had one person raise their hand and ask about, and this is not an FBI person, this is a person attending the National Academy, asked about, you know, well, if being gay and being transgender is normal, what about pedophilia and bestiality? What's going to happen when they make that normal? And So I, you know, I addressed the question, right? You can't just sit there and not say anything. So you, yeah. So, you know, you addressed the question and maybe it was a legitimate question, a legitimately interest question. There's a lot of naivete. We are very lucky in California to have what we have, you know, in terms of a visible community and training.
How did you answer? I'm curious. Do you mind sharing a little bit of what you said?
Yeah, I said, well, I don't think that the American Psychological Association will ever change their view of either pedophilia or bestiality. But even if they did, we have laws in this country that govern behavior. And fundamentally, a sexual act requires consent between all parties involved. Legally, someone under the age of 18 cannot give consent. So it doesn't matter whether you believe it's normal or not, it is illegal. And I don't believe we're ever going to change that. The same is true with sex with animals. Animals cannot give consent. We're not going to change that law. So it's sort of an irrelevant question. There were people that weren't having it. Now, having said that, there were a lot of people who came up to us afterwards and talked and thanked us for the information. Several people said, we have never talked about this at our department before. We got good suggestions about the future. And I think when they have us back, we're going to spend more time talking about things that will help them in their agencies. So how do you create a policy that supports transgender employees when they come out in transition? What are the things you need to think about? How do you respond to all of the animus out in the community right now from pride organizations that don't want you, that don't even want to talk to you and don't want you involved in anything to do with pride organizations? How do you get back into that? How do you create an LGBT liaison program? So we did get invited back. They do want to embed this. They told us when we left that they want to embed this training for all new agents and for the National Academy students, which is great. The FBI staff is very committed to this. Of course, I thought, okay, well, it's one thing for you to say it, but how's it going to play out? And it's played out. We're supposed to go back in February.
Wow, that's just right around the corner, really.
Yep. Yep.
So they want you in person versus an online thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
That, I think that just goes to show you how powerful your panel presentations were.
Yep. Absolutely. There's no doubt that that was the most important thing. And so we're going to spend more time with people storytelling, story sharing. My goal would be to help them develop something that becomes sustainable because, you know, nothing that I present is magic or unique to me. It's information that anybody who understands can present. So we're going to give them all the curriculum that they want, do train the trainers if that's what's needed. We'll develop a cadre of people to help it be sustainable for them.
It's wonderful, the work that you're doing, but I have this other part of me is just sad that in 2021 that the FBI Academy, that there's no cultural sensitivity around the LGBTQ plus.
So they have done for a long time cultural diversity training, and they look at things like racism and, you know, how do you build bridges and how do you build community? They've done that. But they just haven't talked specifically about sexual orientation and gender identity minorities and how they're different and what their experience has been and given people sort of the technical knowledge, just the language to use. They've not ever done that. And of course, the FBI was at the center of the big purge of gay people back in the 1950s and 60s in federal employment. So I think for them, this was historic. The assistant director, when he spoke, called it that, and it was the first time for them. So that's great.
That's fantastic. Gosh, hats off to you. I'm wondering how the staff at Napa College are feeling. How are they feeling about you being presenting to the FBI? I mean,
we've had so much support. You know, the FBI sent a letter out asking for us to come, and our college was just 1,000% supportive. I think they were proud. From what I heard from my bosses.
So we
got a lot of support out of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. You are a treasure.
That's good. Oh, thank you,
Greg. And I do want to say that when you said, you know, nothing I offer is unique to me, anybody can give this training. I don't know. I know you and I know what a good person you are and you sell it. You, if I were to give the training, it would be completely different and probably, or somebody else give the training, it would be completely different. You have the background, you've got the passion, you have wonderful presentation style. So I would just, maybe could I disagree with you for a minute about your offhanded response? Because that's just not what I see, and that's not what I have seen when I see you teach your students at Napa College.
I hope to find other people that have the same passion that will want to carry it on, because as much as I would love to travel back and forth to Quantico and Stafford, Virginia, it's a great place, there's other people that can do the work for them. And so, yeah.
Well, gosh, we want to thank you so much for being here with us. We were wondering, do you have any words of wisdom for any listeners out there? What do you want them to know?
I know you always ask this question.
The person with all the wisdom is sitting right there. So let us hear it.
You know, I think I'm going to fall back to wisdom that's not mine or didn't come from me. It came from my husband, Tony. And he told me this very early on in our relationship, which is people are going to be as comfortable with you as you are with yourself.
Wow, that just gave me chills.
Right on, Tony.
Yeah. And I really think that's true. I really think that's true. You've got to muster that confidence someplace to be good with yourself. And then others will follow.
Beautifully said, Greg. We want to thank you so much for being on our show and as our guest.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. You're so welcome. We're just so honored to have you and get to know you a little bit better.
So, yeah. Thank you, Greg, so much. It's been a pleasure.
You bet.
And we want everyone to know that, like Greg, you too can be living proof that through sharing your wisdom and your experience, you can make our world a better world. And this is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month and next year. Until then,
good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop.
You're listening to KRCB-FM 104.9, Sonoma County's NPR station, and this is our winter fundraiser. If you like what you hear, pledge and support at krcb.org/join. Hi there, I'm Greg Moralia, host of Outbeat News in Depth and the weekly Outbeat News segment here on KRCB. Each week I share stories from the LGBTQ community from around the world and here locally on the Outbeat News segment, which airs at the beginning of every Outbeat radio show on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. And then, on the fourth Sunday of each month, we take an in-depth look at some of the stories making news on Outbeat News in Depth. Thanks for listening to KRCB-FM 104.9. And remember, your support makes our programs possible. Pledge your support now by going to krcb.org/join.
What have you done today to make you feel proud? You could be so many people if you make that grab for freedom. What have you done today to make you feel proud? Yeah, we need a change. My spirit rising, change, yeah. We need a change, yeah. So do it today, yeah. 'Cause I can see a clear horizon.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.